Florida is in need of more novel coronavirus tests. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Democratic Congressman Ted Deutch has been hosting roundtable discussions in South Florida, trying to help people find answers about the virus. He says one challenge for Florida is testing kits.
No one could identify the number of tests that are available in Florida. That's the first order of business for me.
We spoke to the congressman about the federal response and the Democratic presidential race. Also, Miami leaders last week canceled two major events because of COVID-19. What will be the economic impact for businesses not having Ultra and Gaia Ocho? What other events could be canceled? Finally, director Josh Fox made waves with his documentary, Gasland, a look at the dangers of fracking. The environmental filmmaker's in Miami for a one-man show. This time, he's tackling truth. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The federal government will spend $8 billion to battle the new coronavirus. That will encompass getting more testing kits and creating more treatment opportunities. Earlier today, we spoke with Democratic Representative Ted Deutch. He's been hosting a series of roundtable discussions in South Florida with other local representatives and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence. Now, we spoke with Congressman Deutch before he flew back to Washington, D.C., about the federal response to coronavirus. We also touched on his endorsement of Vice President Joe Biden in the Democratic presidential race. Representative Deutch, I wanted to ask you about all the different kinds of conversations that you've been having over the last few weeks in Congress, with the White House. I know you're doing discussions locally, but just some of the things that you're talking about with leaders on strategies and how we should be dealing with this new coronavirus.
The strategy question is the most important one because we're all in this together, and we've had conversations in Washington. We've had briefings in Congress. We had a meeting this weekend with the vice president and the head of the CDC. We've come up with an additional $8 billion in funding to help combat this, over $8 billion, over $2 billion to track the spread of the disease and prevent infections, and $3 billion for a vaccine. That's all important, but the conversations at the local level have been critical. We did a town hall meeting up in Palm Beach County. We just had a roundtable in Broward County, and the local public health officials and nursing home operators and hospitals, the airports and the seaports, these are the people in the community who whose voices are critical now, because we're really all in this together. We need to make sure that people will have access to the tests that they need. We need to make sure that anyone who feels symptoms can be tested. We need to make sure that there is adequate protective equipment for all of our healthcare professionals and our first responders.
Is there? I mean, Florida has had the issue of not having enough testing kits.
Yeah.
I mean, how is that going to be handled? Will that $8 billion go to helping us make sure we have enough of those?
Sure. The test issue is the most critical at the moment, because we need to make sure that we're testing people who have symptoms or people who think they may have been exposed. So in South Florida, there's testing that's being done at the state labs. That's true. There are three state labs. There are corporate labs that are now going to start testing as well. We'll see more people be in a position to test. But the real question is, are there an adequate number of tests? And we just had a meeting with the Broward public health officials, and no one could identify the number of tests that are available in Florida. That's the first order of business for me, is to make sure that there are sufficient tests so that everyone can be tested. Because the way to contain this, the way to prevent this from spreading, is to make sure that we've tested people who are showing symptoms, and that they receive the care they need and don't spread it to others.
Now, you've had a series of roundtables, as you've said, in South Florida. One of them included a conversation with Vice President Mike Pence. One of the things that was discussed is the issue of cruise ships. Now we're hearing from the federal government, avoid them. What about that? That's a big part of our industry here.
It is. And I'll be honest, I was surprised to see the announcement from the State Department, the comments from the CDC, since we had a meeting with cruise officials over the weekend, and the cruise industry understands the threats that they face and the steps they need to take to ensure the safety on their cruises. They're working on a detailed proposal that they were planning to release, I think are still going to release tomorrow, to make the case for why cruising is safe. And then people could decide whether or not they're going to cruise. Certainly for seniors and people with health conditions, there's an acknowledgement that it's always dangerous to be exposed to so many people. But I'm surprised that this message came from the administration right in advance of the cruise industry laying out the way that they were going to address this.
You think about South Florida, and this is that time of year when we get a lot of visitors because of the weather, and we're coming up on spring break. What guidance are you getting on the federal level about large events and large gatherings?
You're right. It's spring break. There are lots of people coming down here. The business community is in contact with the public health officials. There's close collaboration. There's a lot of discussion to make sure that all of the best data is available, and providing transparency, making sure people understand that in Broward there are at least at this moment 3 cases. We're waiting for the public health officials to give us more information about them, but if they're older or if they have serious medical conditions, those might indicate reasons to stay away from large crowds.
I wanted to know what you're hearing from your constituents. What are their biggest concerns? What are the questions they're asking you?
Well, their biggest concerns are, if I feel like I might have coronavirus, how do I get tested? And so we direct them to the county public health offices, and we want to make sure that there are adequate tests so that they can be tested. Hopefully, there will be a rapid test. They're working hard at creating a rapid test to at least do an initial screening so they can identify people who are not at risk or who do not have it. But they want to know that they can be tested. We're getting lots of calls from people who are really worried about their parents or their grandparents. They want to make sure that the nursing homes are safe and have plans to address this. That was a big topic of conversation at our roundtable this morning.
Talking about nursing homes, I mean, especially when you're talking about in communities that are underserved, do you feel confident that the resources are there?
I think that needs to be our primary focus. We recently, just at the end of last week, a number of members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, in a bipartisan way, sent a letter to the administration urging them to focus on the needs in Florida in particular, because we have the highest percentage of seniors and because so many of them have underlying conditions that make them especially at risk. So am I confident? I don't want to sit back and say I'm confident that anyone is fully prepared. I think we have to work every day to ensure that they have the supplies they need, that they have the testing kits, that they have the protective equipment, that they have a plan so that if a case is identified, that person can be quarantined so that he or she won't affect others. What happened in Seattle, I think, is a really good warning sign for us. We have to be vigilant, and we have to start testing right now people who come to visit. Those are the steps that are necessary, and it's not. I'm confident that everyone is aware of how serious this is, but I'm not going to allow myself, nor should anyone allow themselves, to feel confident that we're doing everything we can. There's always more that we can be doing to keep our community safe.
And I want to know a little bit about what you think that should be. When you look at what's happening in Italy, you see what happened in China. You're talking about putting limitations on travel. In China, and I'm not saying that we should compare ourselves, but they shut the whole city down. If this starts to get when you start to see big numbers, what do you think? What are you hearing from the CDC and from other experts as to how to contain this?
Well, you're right. That's the big question. There's a lot of discussion now. We heard this start over the weekend. We'll hear, I think, a lot more of it over the coming weeks, this whole concept of social distancing. And it's inconceivable that we're going to shut down our country, nor should we. But if there is a growth in the number of cases in certain areas, then you look for ways to create that social distancing so that you don't have as many people in close quarters. I don't know what that's ultimately going to look like, but certainly decisions are being made in some areas already. Every location, it's a big country, and I think every location will make their own decisions based upon the data, the number of cases, the steps that are being taken to prevent the spread, and ultimately the best ways to contain them.
Yeah.
That's I think it's going to require, as I said before, there's got to be transparency. The public health officials need to be clear about what's happening, and everyone needs to do their part to take the precautions to prevent the spread, and then ultimately make decisions that they think are in their own best interest.
And we are seeing cancellations in a lot of places, as you pointed out, and here in Miami, the cancellation of the Ultra Music Festival.
The Music Festival
and
was just canceled
Ultra
for that reason.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm speaking with Democratic Congressman Ted Deutsch, representing Florida's 22nd District. The congressman is in South Florida for a series of roundtable discussions about the federal response to COVID-19. Now, you can find more coverage of COVID-19 by going to WLRN.org. I want to switch things up and talk politics because we are still in a primary season, and Florida's primary is coming up. You were a supporter of former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and now you're putting your support behind Vice President Joe Biden. Why Biden? Why not Senator Bernie Sanders?
Vice President Biden gives us the best opportunity to win back the White House. He's someone, especially in Florida, he's someone that everyone knows and is comfortable with. They know who he is. They know what he can accomplish. They've seen him in operation, and they know on the issues that are so critical to us down here, whether it's taking on the urgent threat of climate change or standing up to the gun lobby, he's got a record of success. They know that protecting health care, the Affordable Care Act that he was so instrumental in helping to pass, they know that he's the best position to do that. And most importantly, with Vice President Biden, with Joe Biden, people know that he's a guy who can defeat Donald Trump and bring a sense of decency and unity back to the White House.
You know that Senator Sanders is not shy about stating that he believes that the Democratic Party, that the establishment has been against him, and he's going to fight that. After Super Tuesday, we saw that shift over to Biden, but What was happening within the Democratic Party? Is the whole party shifting over and helping Biden? Is it about trying to stop Sanders?
I really don't understand the attacks on the establishment. Is it the establishment and does he mean the voters in South Carolina or the voters in all of those states that Vice President Biden won on Super Tuesday? No, those aren't establishment people. Those are the people who will help us elect a Democratic president. They went out to the polls on Super Tuesday and they recognized that Joe Biden is the guy who can beat Donald Trump. It's the same. Sure, go ahead.
One of the things that he's pointed out is going back to 2016 and what happened with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz and how the DNC had treated him.
The senator argued, and I think we were all looking at this situation not that long ago, and people viewed Senator Sanders as the front runner. And then Super Tuesday happened and a larger cross section of the country went out to vote. And they voted in big numbers for Vice President Biden. I'm confident that the same thing is going to happen down here in Florida. It's not a question of the only thing that matters is how you're treated by the voters. And what we've seen over the past week is more and more voters have looked at this and are starting to tune in, and they've decided that Vice President Biden gives us the best chance to tackle these urgent crises that we have, to help unite the country, and most importantly, to do all of that by beating Donald Trump. So
now it is the primary season. If Sanders wins, will the entire party get behind him?
I think the party is going to support whoever the Democratic nominee is. And I'm supporting Joe Biden because, as I said, because I think he gives us the best chance to win. I don't think that this is a question about anyone from some unknown establishment providing assistance. It's a question of who's going to decide who gives us the best chance to win in November, because that's clearly what every Democrat wants. It's what independents want. It's what so many Republicans keep telling me they want, which is to put someone in the White House that can help bring the country together. And that there is this growing consensus. The person who's best able to do that is Joe Biden.
Now, regardless of who the nominee is, what is the Democratic strategy to win Florida? Donald Trump took it by a very small margin. It is a tight, very tight state. But what's the strategy?
Well, the strategy is to go out and build the coalition that exists, the great diversity in our state, that will help to propel, I believe, Joe Biden into the White House. And the way that you do that is to draw the distinction between the same way. It's the same way that we won. Democrats won back the House in 2018. You have, you're going to have Vice President Biden. You're going to have the Democratic candidate, whoever it is. You're going to have the Democratic candidate who's working tirelessly and campaigning to protect access to healthcare and expand access to everyone in our country against the President of the United States, who is actively trying to eliminate protections for pre-existing conditions and take healthcare away from millions of Americans. You're going to have the Democratic candidate who recognizes that sea level rise and climate change are affecting us in South Florida right now, and Donald Trump, who thinks that climate change is a hoax. You're going to have the Democratic nominee who's willing to stand up to the gun lobby to help keep our communities safe, and President Donald Trump, who's refused to take any meaningful action since the horrific tragedy at Stoneman Douglas in Parkland.
And we've got elections. So we've got primary elections this week, and Florida's, of course, is coming up on the 17th. Representative Deutsch, always a pleasure. Thank you for the time today.
It's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Democratic Representative Ted Deutsch of District 22 in Broward and Palm Beach County. You could follow our coverage of COVID-19 at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Miami officials postpone the massive electronic music festival Ultra. What will it mean for local businesses? And could other festivals be canceled? It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Ultra Music Festival brings many visitors from across the U.S. and around the world to Miami year after year. This year, that's not happening. Last week, Miami City leaders and Ultra organizers confirmed that the 2020 event is canceled. This amid fears of the coronavirus, or COVID-19. Well, the three-day event was scheduled for March 20th, and many travelers have taken to social media and said they're still coming. Well, the Miami Herald's Joey Fletches has been covering the music festival for a while, and he joins us now. Joey, I know you're disappointed.
Well, I actually found out about this decision, or at least the precursor to the decision, on the same morning I was planning to submit my credential. So, interesting.
There you go. I mean, what have you been hearing from, you know, business leaders, readers, just people in the community overall? How do people feel about the fact that it's done until next year, at least?
There's a range of feelings right now. For as far as business, I mean, this is a big deal for merchants in downtown. There's hotel business. There's a lot of travel and tourism business around this event. The daily capacity for Ultra is 55,000 people. So you're talking about more than 150,000 people over the course of a weekend.
And this year, by the way, it was to remind people, it was coming back to Bayfront.
Right.
Because last year it was over in the Keys. It was
Virginia Key.
Virginia Key, thank you.
And it was sort of a return to form, really.
Right.
That's how it was being billed.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of there's a lot of concern about, well, you know, lost business, but there are still people coming. And so there's concern about, you know, how to build, you know, events around that, and to cater to a tourist population coming for an event that's no longer happening.
So we've seen the numbers of cases in the U.S. continues to rise. We've seen events around the country, different events, either cancel or postpone. But why did the city decide this was the right thing to do?
Well, that represents another side of the coin we were just talking about, right? The concern, the worry that the spread of the new coronavirus that causes the disease, COVID-19, could be exacerbated by an influx of travelers from all over. An event like Ultra Music Festival does bring people from more than 100 countries. It's something that they promote widely. It is a very popular electronic dance music gathering for folks across the globe. City leaders said that's too risky. They said having that many people in one space in Bayfront Park, with Ultra is a music festival. It's fluid, right? You got people that are near each other, dancing around each other, touching. That they were concerned that there was no real way to keep things sanitary enough and organized enough to prevent the potential spread.
But what are they thinking about? This is Miami. This is South Florida.
Right.
So we have a lot of tourists, and they're always all around each other and touching and whatever. I mean, so what's so different about this?
And that's a great question, because it puts into this clear focus, like, at what point, there are folks I've heard from who've raised this very great issue, which is what kind of slippery slope might you create when you do that? I mean, a few days later, the city decided not to grant the special events permit for Calle Ocho Festival on the same... for the same reasons and the same circumstances, thinking that that many people in one, one street, that amount of time, it could impact spread of COVID-19. And so, but where do you stop, right? You're saying it is a big tourist economy. I mean, now there's different advisories every day that are signaling different levels of don't travel. If you do travel internationally, you should self-isolate. I mean, there are things coming at the public.
We're told don't even take cruises.
Right, exactly.
So, but all right, what's the protocol in a situation like this? Or does the city have one for, a virus that, okay, if we see these numbers or we see this happening, we're going to make a decision to shut all this stuff down? How is it supposed to work?
As far as a sort of written code, that does not exist to the level of a response to something like this. They made this decision, they say, using guidelines that are provided by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The guidelines as of last week provided pretty broad discretion. It's really up to the local officials to make decisions on events and whatnot. So they had the power and they used it.
Is it the city or the county? Who has the ultimate authority?
The city has the ultimate authority on Ultra because it has an agreement to allow the festival to use Bayfront Park. Similarly, the city controlled the permitting process for Calle Ocho, but other jurisdictions have other control over other events. For example, the county, they said the youth fair is going on as planned. Just last weekend, Carnival on the Mile in Coral Gables, that went on as planned. The layers of government start to, and the differences in decision-making in those layers of government start to become a little bit clearer in a situation like this, right, where governments can take different actions based on different, literally the same information,
right,
but different sensitivities and different concerns. I mean, Miami Beach, for example, has also taken a stance. They're not... spring break, you can't really cancel spring break, right? Like, that's just too mammoth of a thing, but you can't, they've said, like, we are still, hosting people, we're being extra safe, but, we're, don't not come to South Beach, right? Come to South Beach. That's sort of the message there.
Yeah, they can't cancel spring break, per se, because of the fact that it's just really vacationers.
That's
but there
right.
are events, around spring break, like the music festival, that, they can cancel.
Right, exactly. I mean, spring break, I know, like, having covered Ultra for a few years now, two events that fed off of each other. On a night in South Beach on that Ultra weekend, you could easily find concert goers and folks who are just in town on spring break, feeling, the Big Pink or places like down in South Beach having dinner. That dynamic might change now. I talked to some folks who are trying to get refunds for their tickets and for hotel and airfare, and having some mixed success. For the record, right now, I do not know if Ultra is offering refunds on their tickets. I've been in touch with some ticket purchasers to ask them to let me know once they hear, because they're supposed to be getting a communication from the festival today
And I asked you if not that, they would just credit it for the next year's event if that happens.
That's definitely a conversation that's going around in the community of fans. Some people would welcome that. They'd say, okay, well, I understand the circumstance this year, but you know, I can take it if I know there's going to be one next year and I can go. Which, by the way, we don't necessarily. And this licensing agreement that Ultra has with the city is subject to review potentially every year. I'm not sure what the legalities are just yet of the of this circumstance and how that factors into the existing agreement. Mm. It's an agreement they're actually getting sued on by the downtown residents already. So there's already like a whole host of complications with Ultra as it begins. We, you know, how we move forward from this and what happens next year and how customers are made whole isn't completely clear yet.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Joey Fletch. Is getting the latest on Ultra, the three-day electronic music festival in Miami, officially canceled last week amid fears of COVID-19. And by the way, the Miami Herald wants to know, what are you going to do now that Ultra isn't happening? You know, you can find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Let us know. I also want to know, too, from businesses, you know, how this is impacting you. Calle Ocho, that cancellation, how is it impacting you? You could find us on Facebook and let us know. You talk about the ticket holders, but coming back to locals, how is it going to impact them? I mean, how many businesses really, like, this is huge for them? Or can they survive it because we're a tourist town anyway?
I think there's a mix there. I know that when Ultra first moved from Bayfront Park, there was a hearing where that was decided. There was a contract that could have been renewed, and then it was unanimously rejected by the commission. And then later it ended up at Virginia Key. But some of the folks who came out and spoke in support were some folks who owned bars, restaurants, even I recall one a sign maker. Like a sign printing business that had a lot of business during Ultra, so there is definitely an economic level locally, particularly in the downtown corridor, to an event like Ultra. That wasn't the case in Virginia Key as much, but now Bayfront is where really that impact can be felt. But you know, there are other folks who are in different segments of tourism here that might not feel it as acutely, right? I mean, people come for spring break, for example.
What sense are you getting from, or what have you heard from city leaders about other events or other things that might be canceled? What level are they ready to go to?
It's so, you know, kind of to the point of not having any kind of you know, strict protocol on number of cases triggering XYZ, right? They're viewing every update the way we are from the Florida Department of Health and from CDC, and I think making judgment calls as much as they can on what can go and what can't go. You know, I've heard different announcements in the past couple of days about cancellations that are not related, for example, to the city of Miami. But I know folks are taking that into account. I mean, and it's not even just, by the way, municipalities. I mean, you can see. The James Bond movie got pushed back.
Right.
A tennis tournament in California was pushed back. People are wondering aloud. They've been emailing me. They've been saying, "Well, what's going to happen in Miami Open?" Right. Well, that's not a city decision. It's another local government's decision. Right. So it's fluid. It's fluid, and it's also like you know schools make decisions in a silo too. Right.
Right.
And private businesses may even this. I mean, the city itself has a plan that they've been developing to run on a shorter staff. If for, you know, something were to happen and there was an outbreak in the city government, you know, the majority of them work in a centralized location downtown in
have
a 10-story building. And
have they been asking, you know, any of the employees, city employees, to work remotely?
Not to my knowledge. I know that they've been developing a plan for what if people did need to work from home. And what if people, you know, the city needed to be run on a percentage of its staff, somewhere in like 50 or 40%. So there are conversations already happening about how to make sure that, you know, the folks who are running our local government, and I'm sure it's happening in other local governments, can continue to do so, even if there's a widespread outbreak. And there's also talk about vulnerable populations, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, we talk about Ultra, and that's a population that is very specific to this music festival. But one of the things that the city leaders did bring up when they were justifying this and talking about their reasons was we do have a very large elderly population here in South Florida. And you know, I'll say that in downtown, there's also a population of people living in the street, of unhoused people, homeless people, and they have a particular vulnerability here too. I mean, they, you know, not everybody has access all the time as much as they need to wash their hands, to hand sanitation, to medical facilities, medical care. So, you know, there are other factors that you know, whether you agree with it or not, that were a part of that conversation.
Joey Fletcher of the Miami Herald, again, talking about the cancellation of Ultra. Cayo Ocho Festival has been canceled. Again, each city, each municipality, each, you know, entity, like the school district, local businesses, they will make these decisions as more news comes out about the coronavirus. Joey, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet the environmental documentarian of the film Gasland. He's in Miami for a one-man show about sifting through all the noise online to find the truth. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, 10 years ago, environmentalist, documentarian, and actor Josh Fox released the film Gasland. The Oscar-nominated and Emmy Award-winning film fundamentally changed the fight nationwide around the practice of hydraulic fracturing, that's better known as fracking. Fox has since directed and written numerous other award-winning environmental films. His latest project is a one-man show about the misinformation campaigns spread on social media. It's called The Truth Has Changed, and it's running for the next 2 weekends in Miami. Fox is here in Miami for the shows, and he's going to be meeting with a number of environmental groups over the next 2 weeks as well. Mr. Fox, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
You know, I want to start with Gasland.
Sure.
Because that's the film that really set you up and got you going. You started, though, as an actor studying theater at Columbia University?
Well, I've run my own theater company for the last, I guess, 24 years at this point. I founded a company called International Wow in Thailand back in 1996 when I was a youngin with a group of actors from Asia, and we started to create international performances all over the world.
When did you bring that side of you, you know, the performance with activism? When did those two join?
That's always been the case. I grew up doing the great plays, you know what I mean? I grew up doing Mother Courage of Bertolt Brecht and All My Sons of Arthur Miller and the Glass Menagerie of Tennessee Williams. All these plays, great drama, is the concern is always justice. So that's baked in. And I grew up in New York City as an activist with ACT UP, anti-apartheid movement back in the day. I've always been, that's always been part of my life.
Talking about New York City, I mean, this is, you know, where one of the battleground states, New York State, over the issue of fracking.
For sure.
What was the moment, though, for you when this issue became a part of your life? What was it? Was it somebody introduced you to it? Something you read? Something? What was that?
It's a very unlikely and strange story. They knocked on my door. The natural gas industry. They came knocking in the Upper Delaware River Basin, which is where my parents have a home, and that is the watershed for New York City for 16 million people downstream in New York and Philadelphia and southern New Jersey. And they were seeking to frack. So we got an offer to lease our land for fracking, for gas drilling, for this thing nobody had ever heard of called fracking. And that was a $100,000 offer because we had about 20 acres and they were leasing for about $4,000 or $5,000 an acre. And so that set me off because I'd seen some footage of people who could light their water on fire, who had gas runoff in their streams. And this was absolutely horrifying to me as a person who really values and grew up in nature, in the environment, up and down the Delaware River. And so I went as a sort of virtual unknown. I had, in terms of being an environmentalist, right? I was working with my theater company on issues of the war, of the Iraq war. We were doing a lot of productions that were opposing those foreign wars. The gas industry came calling, and I started to investigate. My work has always been about an inquiry of one kind or another to create new work. So even when I was working with actors in Asia, it was always interviewing them to find out about their lives and what were our issues that we could find some confluence about. So interviewing regular people, not actors, just came as a natural outgrowth of doing that.
This is something that's not happening in Florida, but it is a battle still going on in the Florida legislature to try to prevent fracking here. But just remind people again of what fracking is.
Oh, it's a battle that's going on here.
The legislature's trying to prevent it.
Well,
but
I want to define this a little bit more broadly. But what fracking is a way of pulverizing underground formations of rock to get out oil and gas. And they do that with an enormous amount of water and chemicals and high pressure. So they fracture the underground layers, and that helps extract oil and gas that has been buried under there for centuries or for millennia, right? But what is fracking? Fracking is that technique of getting the gas out, but fracking also represents the largest increase in expansion of fossil fuels in the world today. And actually right now, fracked gas, natural gas, which is proposed by, unfortunately, the Obama administration and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton as the new way to power the world.
And the oil industry, I don't have to tell you, you already know, they'll say this is a safer way than the traditional extraction of oil.
Listen. We've got to get off of fossil fuels. There's no such thing as safe extraction or safe burning of fossil fuels anymore. We're in South Florida. If we don't cut our emissions by 50% in the next 10 years, this city is doomed. That's the science. That's the truth. There is no way around that. We raise sea levels by 5 to 9 meters. Meters, not feet. And that is locked in when we hit 2 degrees. If we don't cut our emissions in half by 2030, you can say goodbye to the entire southern half of Florida.
Well, you know, and we cover this issue a lot here, the issue of sea level rise, at WLRN. When your film came out, though, what was the coverage of the issue of fracking? In just news media, what were you seeing? What were people talking
there
about?
There was no coverage. Fracking was virtually unknown. Gasland is the movie that put that whole issue on the map because of the very famous scenes of people lighting their water on fire. Fracking tends to contaminate water supplies, underground drinking water supplies, with methane and with chemicals. It also pollutes the air all around it. So you have a local environmental catastrophe where you have people who are very harmed by the local industry. You have a regional air pollution situation, which creates horrible asthma rates for kids and regional health problems. And you have a global issue with climate change because you're talking about fracking as the principal competitor for our energy mix with renewable energy.
After this film came out, the oil industry targeted you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what The Truth Is Change is about. The oil industry mounted a $50 million 10-year smear campaign against me, my work, everything that I was doing. And I've come out with 3 films. There's a trilogy, Gasland Part 2, and a film called How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. Those all 3 were on HBO. And the oil industry came out and said that every single thing that I'd reported on was untrue. When we were nominated for the Oscar, they attacked the Oscars. They mounted a very personal smear and misinformation campaign against my work, similar to what climate scientists go through. Similar to what the tobacco industry did to doctors who said that smoking was bad, right? So this is a part of the MO for the oil and gas industry, and it's been that way for decades, and I was the recipient of that. What The Truth Is Change is about is the fact that the people who ran those smear campaigns, in large part, were Steve Bannon, Andrew Breitbart, Fox News. And the connection to Bannon is really one that's alarming to me, because what they did to me by getting underneath my skin, by trying to psychologically terrorize me, follow me home, post all these things online about really do online bullying, is mirrors very, very clearly what Steve Bannon and Cambridge Analytica did and the Trump campaign did in 2016 to terrorize 87 million voters when they were targeting people psychologically and spreading misinformation about Hillary Clinton. And the reason why I'm doing The Truth Has Changed now in 2020 is to call attention to those techniques, which I'm sure they're just going to multiply in this election.
I'm talking with filmmaker, actor, and environmentalist Josh Fox. He directed and written numerous award-winning documentaries, including the Oscar-nominated and Emmy Award-winning Gasland. He's in Miami with a new one-man show that's running for 2 weekends, and you can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Where did the idea, was it the fact that they were targeting you, the gas industry was targeting you, or was what launched this one-man show, The Truth Has Changed?
Well, I never really talked about how difficult it is to withstand a misinformation campaign that's coming after you personally. Now, I was the poster boy for fracking, right? It was really as if all of, and fracking being the largest expansion of oil and gas drilling in the world, you have all the might of the biggest and most wealthiest industry on the planet focused on just you and how they're going to try to knock you off of the reporting that you're doing. It's extremely difficult to withstand that. But when I start to add it up, when I started to see what was going on with Facebook and with social media, because principally a lot of these attacks were coming across social media, right? They were doing it online. They were doing it on Fox News. They were doing it, in every possible way. They followed me around the country for several years, and they created two whole feature films that were aimed to try to counter what I was doing. One of them was called Frack Nation, and the other one was called Truth Land. When I saw what they were doing and how these classic techniques of misinformation and propaganda, realizing that then in 2016, the same people were then tampering with our sense of truth, and that those people now were the predominant ethos for how we report news and how we get information in this country. But the seed crystal was really when a 16-year-old girl, I think a high school girl in the front row of one of my documentary screenings, she raises her hand at the end, end of the film, for the first in the Q&A, she goes, "Josh, how do we know what's true?" She said, "You say all these things about how fracking is bad and climate change is real, but then I can look online and see that people are saying the opposite of all those things. So how do we know?" And I realized I couldn't answer this question, not quickly. I couldn't say, "Well, you have to do your research, you have to do this," because clearly what was going on was online, there was a level of toxicity, toxic data, a different level of pollution that rivaled the pollution that's actually in the ground. This is data pollution that's happening everywhere in our media.
Can you answer that question now quickly? If somebody asked you?
You have to come see the show. The show is about this journey, right? We have to start to understand that the truth is what we are going to base our life and death about, right? Now, I'm a Bernie Sanders surrogate. I believe very much in what's happening in terms of the political revolution. I believe that there are people out there that are young people that are understanding how urgent this climate crisis is. And I have been on the front lines of that all across the world, 500 cities with Gasland and these other films. And The Truth Has Changed has toured all across the nation for about 45 cities for the last 3 years. And I've seen a movement on the ground in this country that is so passionate and enthusiastic and amazing. And on the other hand, I see a lot of the denial of what's happening all around us, right? We're living in coastal cities, New York, New Orleans, Miami, that our days are numbered unless we really take incredibly passionate action. So how do we find out what the truth is? Well, we have to come together, first of all. We have to get involved politically. And that's what this show is about. This show is about understanding the urgency of this climate emergency and how we are to work together to solve it.
As I mentioned before, I mean, you're here for the show, but you're also going to be spending time doing some environmental work. Tell me a little bit about what you're going to be doing, you're working with.
I have never really spent a lot of time here in Miami, but everywhere we go with this show, we partner with environmental organizations and climate change organizations that are passionately defending the environment. So when you come to this show, you're going to find out a lot of very difficult information. It's an emotional roller coaster ride. It goes from 9/11 through the Iraq War, through the BP oil spill, and a lot of my personal journeys through those as a frontline reporter. So it's a harrowing journey. It's also quite a lot of fun. There's banjo in it. There's a lot of stories in it. But you come out the other side really understanding the crisis. So you have to go, you can't just like be birthed into the world with this sense of new information that's really upsetting. We have to then do the next part, which is to provide the audience with a place to go, right? Because once your emotions have been stirred up, once you understand the reality of what's going on, you have to then take action. It's in everyone who sees this show wants to take action. So we work with the local organizers on the ground to give people a sense of how do we participate, because all this has to be community-based and locally-based.
I come back to this idea that you just mentioned, you know, as a young woman would come up to you and ask you after one of, you know, your shows, how do we know what the truth is when there's so much information out there? And as you said, you know, for all the truths, there are many lies as well. This comes to an interesting story that you know well. This is a very unique story here in Miami back in 2016. This is about the viral image of an octopus.
Oh, yeah.
That was floating in Miami Beach parking garage after a king tide. Now, look, we have the king tides, and we talk about a lot of the issues that they bring, but there are these weird, quirky stories that go with it. Tell me how the octopus is the 21st century version of climate change's the canary in the coal mine.
Well, you're giving away my project after this one. Okay. But for me, you know, there are moments where the world never is the same ever again. And often those have been human harbingers, people who have come to us and say, you know what, things are not going to be the same. We're going to change reality. That's Henry David Thoreau. That's Susan B. Anthony. That's, that's Martin Luther King. But in this case, this is the earth itself. This is the ocean itself coming to say, guess what? We're coming from Miami, right? This is not a coincidence. This is not an accident. The fact that the ocean is invading this city is a harbinger of what is to come. So in my imagination, the earth is speaking to us very clearly when it's saying we're going to have these extreme storms. We're going to have octopuses walking around in parking garages. We're going to have be able to fish in downtown. I heard that people were fishing in Miami Beach at high tide. You know, these are the kinds of things to me that say the world is never going to be the same. We have to pay attention. And the earth is speaking in those are every bit as articulate and eloquent as some of those great world leaders. And we have to heed that. We have to pay attention to that.
And the other aspect of that story is the fact that when it came out, there are people who are claiming it's a hoax. This comes back to the show
right.
about the truth.
Right.
And what exactly am I supposed to believe?
Right.
Because there's, everything online.
Well,
I could doubt. I could be skeptical.
Well, but there's, you got to understand that there are very powerful forces that are benefiting from keeping the truth from you, from obscuring the truth, specifically about climate change, specifically about economic justice, specifically about what we have to do, to solve this problem, right? The oil and gas industry spent 10 years attacking me. I know them intimately because they have brought out every trick in the book to try to make me sound like, like I'm saying things that are not true. The bottom line is their business model has to end. We have to stop using fossil fuels. What do we have to do to get there? We have to have a Green New Deal. The Green New Deal says we're going to dismantle the fossil fuel infrastructure. We're going to build solar and wind, which is actually cheaper than fracking and cheaper than fracked gas. Right now, we have 177 fracked gas power plants scheduled to come online in the United States. What does that mean? That's the end of Florida. That is the end of the south of Florida. There is no way. You can either have the 177 fracked gas power plants or you can have Miami. You can't have both. So what we have to have is a Green New Deal where we are actually vigorously transforming our energy system. And how do we get there? By learning the truth about climate change. How do we get there? By learning the ways in which the oil and gas industry smears and misinforms people who are coming out and telling the truth, like scientists, and how they alter reality.
No, I caught it. You said something. Is this another project you're working on?
What?
With the octopus?
Well, I think that every... one of my projects in the future is going to be about climate change, right? Because that is the main story right now. That is the apocalyptic thing that's coming, right? It's here already, right? My girlfriend's from the Virgin Islands. I watched firsthand as all of 60% of that island was completely destroyed. I'm from New York City. I watched, I visited homes where New Yorkers drowned in their own homes, right? I've been to Paradise, California with people who ran with their children in their arms, fleeing as their neighbors were burning alive in their cars. I've seen the devastation in Colorado with the fires that have completely annihilated the Fort Collins area. I've been in the South Pacific with people whose islands are about to go underwater because of sea level rise. This is an emergency. That's what I'm trying to say. The octopus is one tiny little, very kind of YouTube-friendly version of understanding that emergency. But let's not make light of this, because the truth of the matter is this is going to cost millions and millions of people their lives. When we're talking about 2 degrees of warming, which is right around the corner, like I said, if we don't cut our emissions by half in 10 years. Emissions are going up right now, right? So we have to reverse that and cut them in half in the next 10 years, or else we're going to 2 degrees. 2 degrees is locked in. At that point, we have massive, massive changes. We have almost a billion people who have to migrate because places, and some of them will be coming from South Florida, right? So the idea here that we're not digesting the emergency, that is what is at the bottom of all of this. That is the truth. And the truth is that right now, human beings could completely devastate our own civilization. That's one of the ways in which our truth has changed. In the same way as when the atomic bomb happened, that meant humanity was changed. Now we understand, this is the first generation to know what the global apocalypse will look like. That is a way that the truth has changed.
And as one man show again is called, as he's been saying, the truth has changed. He's going to be performing it here for the next couple of weeks, for a couple of weeks here in Miami. And you can go to our social media at WLR and Sundial, find out when those shows are going to run. Josh Fox, again, creator of the Oscar-nominated Emmy Award-winning documentary, Gasland. Josh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that is our program for this Monday, March 9th. So Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabkin. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Well, coming up tomorrow on Sundial, it's 6 months since a Category 5 hurricane slammed into Grand Bahama and the Abaco Islands. WLRN's Daniel Rivero recently went back to the Bahamas to look at the environmental damage. And the March Sundial Book Club selection is Jaquita Diaz's Ordinary Girls, a memoir. And we spoke with Jaquita last week about growing up in Puerto Rico and Miami Beach in the 1980s. She'll explain how she managed with a mother with severe mental illness. You can always join the Sundial Book Club. Just go to Facebook, find Sundial Book Club, ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. Tell us what you think of the book. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.